Or is it a little too loud, too echoey? It's okay. All right. Oh, is it printed badly?
Yeah, very bad.
Oh, something went wrong there, eh? Oh, that's a pretty big mess. I have, is it just this last part?
No, yeah, the last part, like 5 days.
Okay, so, it's just a problem with the...
We can share.
You're happy to have mine, except that it's in the main...
We can share.
Okay, good. Okay. Okay. Our last of the Whipalasa, perceiving ugliness as beauty. And you already saw the most dramatic of the slides. Isn't it, though? Which one do you find more beautiful? It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Like, it depends on how we look at things.
Actually, the top guy on the right is beautiful.
Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, not the bottom one.
Bottom one, you get a little more of the inner guts. How many of you have seen the Body Worlds exhibit? Okay, yeah. Yeah, our community did a little celebration of our 12th anniversary as a community by going to the Body Worlds exhibit in San Jose, California. And it's my third time I've been to one of the exhibits, and I always find it really fascinating to really... it's kind of weird, isn't it, because they use... plastic, basically, and it kind of looks like the body parts are plastic now, you know, a little bit. But it's very, it's also very informative and visually impactful, you know, to be able to see like the circulatory system highlighted in see the tendons and the ligaments, and of course the organs, and particularly a lot of the bodies, the lungs. The people were smokers. So the lungs are black. Yeah, compared to a non-smoker, where they're more, peachy color or something. So, one of the contemplations that's really encouraged when a monastic has lust is to take off the skin, as I mentioned before. When I first went into robes, I was living with one other bhikkhuni, and we were in the Bay Area, but it was kind of a small historical town area. There was an old kind of general store there. And she wanted to go on alms round, like I described before, every day, I think it was, during the three-month rains retreat period. And so we would walk through town, and we got to know this shopkeeper a little bit. And a few other people that hang around, And... one day, one of the guys who was hanging around produced a drawing of us, except that our robes were see-through. It's pretty shocking. And I felt a little uncomfortable with that. And later we were visiting the monk in that there was a temple there, which is really why this new little vihara, it was just myself and this bhikkhuni that I was learning from. And we were kind of planted there because there was this really good monk who had had a Thai temple there for a long time. And he was very supportive. You know, there's all the gender discrimination and everything. There are certain ways that the monks are supported that they can get away with, you might say. He was very supportive. And the bhikkhuni I was with told the monk about this. And he asked me what I would do about that. Or, you know, like I said, I wanted to like take it, rip it up, throw it away. And he said, you know, what might be helpful is to tell the person you haven't gone deep enough. And I was like, that's brilliant. Because, I don't know, I've got a book of Body World's images, and I've been using it for body contemplation. And, you know, sometimes when you see the muscular system like that, it is quite beautiful, and actually more modest than the skin in some kind of interesting way. However, if we walked around like that, I think it'd be a little hard, don't you? I wonder if they could make AI glasses that you look and you just...
Like X-ray glasses.
Yeah, it just kind of like right through this, you know, a new kind of alternate reality.
You can switch the channel.
Ooh, what would you switch it to?
Whatever else you want.
On or off.
Or on or off.
Yeah. So now some poems. So this is the monk Abhaya. Abhaya means fearless. It's like Abhaya Giri. Giri means mountain, and Abhaya is fearless. It's the fearless mountain. When you see a sight, mindfulness is lost as you focus on a pleasant feature. So this is a key concept, that when we see something we like, we lose our mindfulness. Again, we're just focused on what we like about it. Experiencing it with a mind full of desire, you keep clinging to it, and your defilements grow, leading to the root of rebirth, that craving of wanting to exist and be and do and have. When you see a sight, mindfulness is lost as you focus on a pleasant feature. Experiencing it with a mind full of desire, you keep clinging to it. Your defilements grow, leading to the root of rebirth. Here's another bhikkhu. Lakuntaka Bhadia. The monk's name is Bhadia. He lives in a beautiful forest monastery called Ambataka. Having uprooted craving, he meditates there happily. To enjoy themselves, some people need drums, lutes, and cymbals, but I don't need any of those. I'm sitting at the root of this tree, delighting in the path of the Buddha. If the Buddha were to grant me one wish, and I were to get what I wished for, I'd choose for the whole world constant mindfulness of the body. Isn't that an interesting wish? Boy, that would change up things. Some people make fun of me when looking at my physical appearance, but others get carried away by my sweet voice. Both groups are captured by desire and passion, and they both don't know who I really am. They don't see my internal life, nor do they see my external life. Those foolish people are obstructed all around. They're just carried away only by my voice. Not knowing what's inside, but seeing what's outside, seeing the fruit outside, they're also carried away by my voice. Understanding what's inside and seeing what's outside, those of unobstructed vision don't get carried away by a voice. So I think knowing, not knowing what's inside, but seeing what's outside, you know, so they're the ones who don't see either side, they're just carried away by the voice. There's the ones that they see, they don't know what's inside this person, but they see what's outside, and they see the fruit outside. And I think that might mean the monastic form, and, you know, they see the you know, maybe his calmness or whatever, but they're still carried away by a voice. But when someone really understands what's inside and seeing what's outside, unobstructed vision, with unobstructed vision, they don't get carried away by a voice. And I think there's something valuable there in thinking about what makes us get carried away. Because when we're carried away, we lose our mindfulness. We get caught up in things. Any comments so far? Yeah, Adam?
Is the swamp, like, famous for having a beautiful voice or something,
I wonder? I don't know, but I'm sure that must be true, you know. Yeah. And not a very comely appearance, apparently. You know, people make fun of him. Yeah?
Yeah, I was just thinking, if you gravitate towards the voice, then it obliterates everything else.
Mm. You don't really see anything
else.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really true. Mm-hmm. Yeah, everything just fades into light. That's what you see by distorted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this reflection that we're going to engage in for the next 24 hours for a little more deeply is that, like, what causes us to really... for things to be obliterated. Yes, Lisa.
I'm just wondering where art falls in this idea, an artist, a painter, a sculptor. I can just think of a landscape painter I know, and mm-hmm. we talk about how carefully he observes a tree.
Yeah.
So well, is that being
it depends on
carried?
His mind.
Okay, that's what I'm
it
wondering.
Depends on his mind. You know, to really observe a tree requires a lot of mindfulness. And you don't see, like, a brown, you know, like, how do you draw a tree? I'm still, like, 9 when I draw a tree. You know what I'm saying? We've got an image in our head when we hear the word tree. And it's not the tree he's going to draw. He's going to paint the tree as it is. Perhaps that's what his thing is. Maybe it's not. Maybe he's going to paint an impression of the tree. But still, there's an attention. If, depending on the mind of the artist, there might be an attention on detail that requires a lot of mindfulness and produces a tremendous calm as they do the work. It can be very, very meditative. and you can see into it. And sometimes as we observe it, we can see into it. So the mind of the artist can be one of two ways. And the mind of the viewer can be one of two ways. Mindful and aware, attentive of what we're seeing and what's behind what we're seeing or what we're not seeing. Or just carried away by the beauty of the painting. Letting the mind drift and fluff and, you know, not be mindful. And that's really true of objects in general, or sense impression in general. And before we go farther, I want to repeat the questions that you didn't have a microphone, right? And what was your question again? Sorry.
I had just asked if that monk was like well known for having a beautiful voice. Maybe he was a singer before a monk or something.
Right.
Just seems like there's something that we aren't told about.
Yes. In the poems, we're not told. There's a whole bunch of stuff we're not told. And the suttas, too, and that's why the commentary fills in a lot of the detail. But I don't know if they say anything about this. Maybe they do. We could check it out. And what did you say, Debbie? It was...
Yes.
The voice, everything else.
Yes, when you fixate on one particular object or sight or sound, whatever, everything else is obliterated.
Mm-hmm.
If you're totally fixated, yeah.
Yeah.
So that everything, yeah, it's a true distortion, and you can really see that as a distortion. It's just jumps right out at you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's wonderful.
Yep. And we're focused on what we like. You know, it's natural for us to go towards the beauty, what we find beautiful.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that in deep meditation, if you read Ajahn Brahm's Art of Disappearing, and he talks about the nimitta stage before entering jhana, and if there's a bright, really beautiful light, you'll just want to absorb into it, and that can be useful if you're not attached, if you're not, like, holding on to it too tightly or... Other ways that we can kind of like lose it. So we had some hands back here a minute ago. And I don't know who was first. There we go. Janine.
I guess just in response to what was asked about art, specifically landscape art, I would imagine I know the answer to this, but would the same approach be with the human body, like nudity?
I mean...
And
there's a lot more that comes up for me when I think about nudes and art and exploitation and confusion and lust and... You know, it's a really slippery slope.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I was just curious because I think of... I mean, there's so many different topics of it, but, I mean, even just thinking of... I danced my whole life and having watched modern dance where both men and women were nude or at least topless, figure drawing, I think even... working with the body, although there's draping involved, like it's still a, I guess, sensual experience, but not sexualized. Like it's a...
In my experience, it's pretty stimulating sexually. And... There was a time when I finished ministry school and I was trying to figure out what I really wanted to do for work, and I considered massage therapy because I felt like that's a way to meditate while working, right? And I had already like been around the monasteries quite a lot, and I didn't want to work on men. I just wanted to work on women. And the places I inquired at none of them would allow that that constraint in terms of training you. And I was talking to my son, who is still a monk at that time, about it, and he said, well, yeah, that's what people want. They want the excitement. And my experience, you know, you could say, well, it doesn't matter to me if a man gives me a massage or a woman gives me a massage. And maybe in my case, maybe it doesn't, because I could be attracted to either. But there is a kind of, like, stimulation that we like. They don't want to limit it because people like that. They want the sexual stimulation of that feeling, and they want to do it, and they want to, you know, like, well, it's all okay because it's socially acceptable in this context. But is it okay for the mind? What does it do to the mind? And from my perspective, my mind gets agitated, and I don't want it. It affects the meditation, it affects my sense of groundedness and stability, it carries you away. And if a sensual experience is carrying you away, you're not seeing clearly what's what.
I hear that. And thank you for sharing that. While also, I guess for me, and I am a massage therapist, and I can understand how it can easily get swept away. But also, I guess, because with everything we're speaking about, like, part of the practice, or what I find so healing about working with a body, moving with a body, is the actual practice of, like, disassociating from it being lustful, stimulating, and seeing it as everything we've been speaking of today, just this physical entity that is not connected to anything else. But if we are to be here and be in the body, how can I support others in healing, alleviating?
Yeah, again,
suffering.
It comes down to the person themselves and where the mind is. And the mind can change so quickly, like we said, and lust can shoot up at any point in time. And then do we have the skill to deal with it properly? And that's part of what you should, you know, you train to understand. I think we take it a big step deeper if we start practicing renunciation in various areas of our life. And so the beauty, I think we might see, I think there might be something in this, in the text we're going to look at tonight around this. One of the things I loved about, or I love about being around monastics, is the safety. Mm. You know, and in our tradition, we're not supposed to be alone with someone from the opposite gender. And if there's attraction for, you know, whoever, don't be alone with them. It's a safety for everybody. And later somebody doesn't, even, you know, they couldn't even falsely accuse a good monk of having done something because there's somebody else there. It's all really on the up and up, really safe. When you see, you know, having that vow really changes the game. And it's not like I expect that for everyone in lay life, or not like I'm trying to tell you that you should go that way. It's just that whatever we're doing, whatever our life includes, however we relate with each other and however we love each other, to be present, aware of how we might harm each other, or when we're actually trustworthy. How can we be so absolutely trustworthy that no one fears us? Or no one feels like they were taken advantage of later?
Yeah, I think that takes a lot of safety and a lot of, communication, integrity.
Well, and integrity. Yeah. The integrity has to be so deep. We have to prove ourselves with integrity. It's not enough to just tell someone you care about them, or they tell you they care about you and it's okay to be with me. It's not enough. We have to see people in their inaction. We have to see them resist temptation.
Thank you.
Someone else back here.
Is this urgent?
No, it's strong.
She can hold it, I know.
Thank you for opening the topic that seems to be pretty hot.
It is one of those hot ones.
And as the world is on fire, it's pretty interesting to notice these sanctioned behaviors that have come through the aeon, you know, where people aren't necessarily thinking about these things. So what came to mind in the comment that I wanted to make was it reminds me a little bit of the usefulness of the Vedana practices, so that when one sees
feels,
senses that draw toward, mm-hmm. that there's another place to go. And it certainly has been hugely impactful in my life and practice. It hasn't been mentioned here, so...
Well, I'm not sure it hasn't. I mean...
Not directly. I haven't heard of it.
You know, we've been talking a little bit about when feeling arises, being present with it, not suppressing it, letting it fade on its own. And... You know, Vedana usually refers to painful, pleasant, or neutral feeling. But then, you know, pleasant feeling can immediately be emotional, you know. So we want to be sure we're, in a practical sense, really addressing all of it. And I think it is the same as what you're saying. Would you agree? Or is there something else there that you intended?
I don't need to agree. It was a feeling that I wanted to share about being reminded of that practice.
Oh, I just meant in the practice, as you experience it, do you see something else that we would benefit from drawing out?
This is language, and it's very particular in the way that we first learn it and then mm-hmm. practice it. I learned it differently than has been spoken here.
Okay.
And it has accentuated the spaciousness of the middle way, of the non-judgmental self-awareness that arises as a result of realizing the push and pull of the desire or the aversion. And so for me... when I hear the very natural human, my example that brings it really down to a point for me mm-hmm. is when my niece decided to go gender neutral. And the way in which the family responded these last several years has been remarkably revelatory around the identification of male-female identities. Mm-hmm. And it was so beautiful to listen to this very smart and PhD out of MIT say, no, this is how I know myself to be. Uh-huh. And to truly use her smarts and her chutzpah as a 20-something to say, this is what I'm doing. Uh-huh. And so the remarkable societal transformation that those who are choosing that path I see very much in this poem, in fact, and the inquiry of the evening, because we're seeing it change at that collective level, right? Knowing that that's where I'm trying to track how these systems are changing, how individual behaviors through practice, through something that arises as a benefit of practice from similar enough traditions, not necessarily this tradition.
Right.
So I just wanted to... honor my dear niece because mm-hmm. she would love this.
Yeah.
She would love this, and she has nothing to do with the practice. Mm-hmm. So I just, it's another way.
Yeah, we see this emerging in people who are practicing and are in our community. And it's great. It's great reflection. It's wonderful exploration and finding it within ourselves to support those shifts and changes. Yeah, thank you. Okay.
Yeah.
Suzanne.
My hand went up at the former earlier conversation, but I was really taken aback by your assertion. It seemed like a fairly clear assertion that we can't escape gender. I mean, or that I don't know if that was the language of it, but the language that I heard was, you know, this had to do with the amount of stimulation that you are offered, that you're going to pick it up sometime, someplace, and that it's always going to be there for people. And I guess my response came from my life as an artist, where I have spent, you know, hours and hours doing figure drawing with nude models, male, mm-hmm. female, gender neutral, gender everything. Mm-hmm. And how that process, if you're really investigating, I mean, because it really is an investigative process, if you're really investigating, you stop thinking at all about the gender.
Yeah.
And you don't think of sexuality at all. You just think of, that's the way the knee kind of goes, and it's, you know. And
I understand. I've also drawn.
Yeah.
And again, it's the same answer, really, as what we were talking about here before with Lisa, drawing the tree, right? It's like, it depends on the artist, and it depends on who's looking. And I wasn't trying to say that we can't escape gender. It's that we, as human beings, we are conditioned through eons of evolution, or however long, not eons, but, you know, through evolution to have lust arise, to be attracted. And we want to monitor that and be careful about it. And we don't want to use it in the wrong way.
Right.
We don't want to participate in things that are just scintillating and not respectful of what that process really is. So it's not really about gender, even though I used a genderized way of describing my experience, because, you know, it's in the monastic form, we're still working with that quite a bit, you know, the whole gender thing. But it's like, it's more, and then what it comes down to and what you're describing, it's really what are we doing with it? And again, what we were talking about with Janine too, is like, what is the practitioner might be totally, you know, with integrity, with none of that coming up, or it could flash up at any moment. And then are we carried away by it? That's the point. I mean, you know, this is a sensitive region where we need to be really conscious and caring, not about satisfying our own desires, but about, this is a human being, mm-hmm. and are we really respectful? Are we really safe?
Yeah,
whatever we're doing, right? Yeah. I mean, how often do we have instances where people are taken advantage of in all kinds of situations where there's a power differential, whether it's in therapy or it's ministry or it's the monastic life or wherever it is? You know, we have to really like develop and maintain our integrity.
Well, and call out people who are crossing boundaries.
Definitely. Yes. Definitely. And it comes back to this idea of losing our mindfulness. You know, I mean, even though you think, well, I'm never going to, you know, do something like that, and maybe hopefully that's true. However, human beings are human beings. We have all these urges. We have all this craving. We have all these desires. We have all these feelings, and they shoot up. And we need to know how to work with them and see the downside, see the danger. Yes.
This is one of those moments where I can't believe I'm saying this out loud in a room full of people whose names I don't even know. I just wanted to comment on in our culture, celibacy is for monastics, or typically treated sometimes jokingly as this unwilling state that people without partners are suffering through. And I've been partnered up for 50 years on May 25th.
Congratulations.
And 4 years ago, I started taking 8 precepts every Uposatha. And first I just did it for 24 hours, and then for 3 days, and then for 6 days. And now it's from every full moon to new moon. And I would say that this chosen celibacy has increased the trust and intimacy and caring in our relationship in just an amazing way. Mm-hmm. And
thank you.
It's for everyone.
Well, I had a very strong experience, lots of sexual desire. I had a really important relationship had recently ended. This is long before I even, wasn't that long before I was starting to visit monasteries, but I didn't know much yet about the Dhamma. And with all of the, my heart was wrecked. It was such a difficult change for me. And the sexual energy was high from time to time. And, you know, the guys I'm working with start looking good. And I'm like, oh, man, I'm in trouble. Sorry, guys. And I had this idea, for whatever reason, that I should not do anything. I didn't want to do anything. I didn't want to get involved with anyone. I didn't want to gratify that on my own in any way. I just decided I'm just going to be present with this raging feeling. And what I noticed was that it lasted about 3 or 4 days, and then it tailed off on its own. And I didn't go blind or anything. and then it pop up again. And again, the guys at work are looking good, and I'm like, okay, I'll just be present with this intensity. And what I noticed was that the next time it came up, it wasn't as hard. It wasn't as like, I just got to hold my breath and deal with this as bad. It would taper off more easily. And then I started to track it. It happened about once a month. Hello? And then I wasn't slave to it anymore. I didn't have to get involved in anything I didn't want to get involved in. I wasn't driven by it anymore. And it was maybe months only later, I was in Thailand visiting my son, and Ajahn Jayanta was there. I remember him helping me. When he introduced himself to me, he said, "Thank Giant Toe." to keep his name can't remember his name. Big giant toe. Giant toe, okay. But I was telling him about this, and there were a couple of other monks there, my son for sure, and he said, that's renunciation. Okay. I didn't know really what that was. And he said, you know, he talked about, you know, setting a period of time that you're going to, like, restrain yourself and that kind of thing. But he said that like, not wanting to do anything to except be present with that experience was renunciation. And the power of it was really, it just was such a great instruction for me. Like, you go through the real tempest, and then you know I can handle feeling. Sarah.
Just a couple quick thoughts. One is, this is sort of interesting is to me and speaks to maybe the skillfulness of some of the practices around sort of cultivating disgust, is that that's actually part of the excitatory process in our humanness when we come in contact with these things, is we actually... Our sensitivity to disgust is actually suppressed.
Yes.
As part of the excitatory process. And I thought that was really interesting. I'm not quite sure what to make of that, but...
But it's a very important point, I think, because it's part of the delusion. You know, we're just not as disgusted by the fact that these fluids are wherever they are. And if I look back on it, it's like, why did I do that? You know, it's like... Yeah. So just I think it's true. Our tendency to disgust is suppressed. I never really thought about it before, but it's like, yes, this is part of the delusion.
The other question I guess I had was, is there a way in which taking, if you are someone who has incredible difficulty connecting with other human beings intimately, is there a way that taking a precept to not, or taking on that training of renunciation, sexual renunciation or whatever, is somehow sidestepping a growth process?
Again, this is important for the individual to understand about themselves. There's all kinds of spiritual bypassing, you know, avoidance of looking at whatever. Hopefully you get some help in the environment from your teacher, from your fellow monastics to work through that. But you definitely don't want to, you know, a lot of people think people become monastics to hide from the world. The world is right there. You're still going to have your stuff come up, and you really need to work with it. It doesn't work otherwise. You know, we see what happens when a group or some, you know, something, they decide to try to suppress this stuff, it comes out in harmful ways. So yeah, you have to make sure that's not what's happening. There's a beautiful line in the movie The Bells of St. Mary's. I don't know, it's like in the 40s, right? And it's about this young girl who wants to become, says she wants to become a nun. And Ingrid Bergman is the head nun. And she says, that's not how it is. You don't become a nun. How's it go? Yeah, it's that. That's the idea. But the line is better than that. You don't become a nun to get away from something. You become a nun because you found something, and you have to like find the beauty in the celibacy if that's what you want to do. Find the safety, the integrity, and not. And this is not an advert for celibacy. It's an advert for integrity. And whatever it is we're doing with our sexual energy, that it's really harmless, really supportive, really loving. Not the fake kind of, I love you because of the way you make me feel. I don't think that's love, really.
I'm not sure exactly what I want to say here, but I think so much of sexuality is not really about sex, you know.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about how much simpler my life actually got when I made the vow to my husband that was going to be it. Mm-hmm. You know, and it has never been difficult. Mm-hmm. I don't really know why, but I do have this thing about vows. And
about what?
About vows. You
yes.
know, having said, okay, well, this is it. And it's.
I love that about you.
And, you know, I've barely given it a second thought. You know, little things passed by when I was younger in my head. But, you know, certainly as I've grown older, it just simplifies everything.
Yes. Yes.
So there is something about, you know, whether it's to celibacy or to be faithful to another human being, mm-hmm. that really transcends the act of sex.
It does.
You know?
It's way more than that.
Yeah, it's way
it's
more
way
than
more
that.
Than that. Yeah. It's like when the Buddha says that if a monk is, like, loving listening to this woman singing on the other side of the fence, he's not being celibate.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you're really committed to someone, it's way more pure than not messing around with somebody else.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 There are all sorts of things that I can just, you know, think of that I wouldn't do that have absolutely nothing to do with sex, but that uh-huh. might make something a little uncomfortable in the relationship and vice versa.
Yes.
So, you know, it's not that it's old-fashioned. It's just like it's based on sort of mutual respect.
Yep. And real love.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. real love doesn't mean you feel good all the time.
Oh, no.
Well, okay, the truth is we never feel good all the time, no matter what we're up to. But it's still, you know, this is the third precept. This is what we all should be doing.
Mm-hmm.
Regardless of whatever form or who we're attracted to or any of that, this is what we should be doing.
Well, it's so interesting that we're having this conversation. I've been reading Natalie Goldberg, and I've been reading the one book about her spiritual awakening with Katagiri Roshi. And then the second book about the discoveries of his misconduct with mm-hmm. students,
yeah.
which that story is played out, unfortunately, in other traditions as well.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, the way you're talking about celibacy and vows is so beautiful. And it's exactly the kind of teaching that I would be drawn to follow. And this is the thing. I've been knowing about these teachers for decades.
Yeah.
And it is the thing that has kept all of this teaching at arm's length for me.
Yeah. And
because,
good. I mean, that's, yeah. you don't want any of that.
Yeah.
Or
yeah.
anything that could create that.
Yeah. yeah.
Or allow that.
Yeah.
And yeah. allow it to continue to happen. And so we have this, sometimes other nuns from other traditions will talk to us about the things that are happening in their tradition and how a teacher can be so flagrantly abusive, sexually abusive, to nuns and to women, followers, and they're still being propped up as a great teacher, and they say things like, oh, this is my blessing for you. Oh, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. So twisted.
Yeah, and I mean, and I'm talking in my experience, not just about Buddhism, but in yoga, in many different kinds of spiritual explorations.
And it's so damaging. It's so much danger in it.
So
damaging. It's just such a corruption of the beautiful gift of Dhamma, regardless of whatever the religion is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This kind of integrity is absolutely essential. And we have to be willing to call it out when it's not there. And we have to be willing to look at our own behavior, really, really be mindful, really be present. Not get carried away by any sensual stimulation. And it's not a crackdown. It's not like you're stiff. It's not like you're controlled. It's you're wise and you're aware.
You're awake.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, you're woke in the right way.
That's right.
Indisputable.
Yeah. Wow, I didn't expect to go there. Okay.
Turned away by the voice.
It's good though. It's good to have this frank conversation. Okay, Ananda. At one time, Venerable Ananda. So this part is actually prose. And then we get to the verse. And one time, Venerable Ananda was staying near Savati in Jeta's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. And then Venerable Ananda robed up in the morning. You know whose translation this is. This is Bhante Sujata. He robed up in the morning and, taking his bowl and robe, entered Savati for alms with Venerable Vangisa as his second monk. Venerable Vangisa was a poet before he became a monk. And he would say something like, Blessed One, a spontaneous verse arises in my mind. And the Blessed One would say, go for it, Vangisa. And he was so amazing. And his verses in the Theragata are the longest. I mean, he just like on and on. It's very cool. Really good poet. And at that time, Venerable Vangisa became dissatisfied as lust infected his mind. And then he addressed Ananda in verse. I've got a burning desire for pleasure. My mind is on fire. Please, out of compassion, Gotama, tell me how to quench the flames. Your mind is on fire because of a distortion of perception. Turn away from the feature of things that's attractive, provoking lust. See all conditioned phenomena as other, as suffering and not self. Extinguish the great fire of lust. Don't burn up again and again. With mind unified and serene, meditate on the ugly aspects of the body. With mindfulness immersed in the body, be full of disillusionment. Meditate on the signless. Give up the underlying tendency to conceit. And when you comprehend conceit, when you really comprehend conceit, you will live at peace. And I put a note at the bottom to explain signless. This is the same word we were talking about earlier, nimitta. This is nimitta. This is the way Pali negates. So the not sign, the signless, and the commentator there, that's what SPK is. It says it's insight. It's vipassana. So-called because it strips away the signs of permanence and, you know, pleasure and self.
Can you say something about that word conceit? Hmm. I think it's a slightly more nuanced meaning.
Yes, usually when they're talking about conceit in this way, it's more like the final sense of I am. So in the first level of awakening, in the Sotapanna, where you realize that none of these khandhas can possibly be self or any collection of them, that's a big step. But there still can be a sense of I am, the sense of there's a still an identity there of some kind. And that doesn't fall away until arahantship. So really penetrating that sense of self at a very deep level. I also see it used as the kind of more common usage, I think, of, you know, kind of being like superior or inferior. It's related, but I think here the deeper insight is intended. Sundari Nanda. She was the Buddha's half-sister. So, you know, that the Buddha was born to Queen Maya, or, I don't know, they weren't really kings and queens, but... And Maya died about a week after the Buddha was born. His mom died. And then his auntie, who was also one of the wives of his father, took care of him, and raised him, and nursed him, and everything. And she also had a couple of other children later. And one of them was Sundari, which means beautiful. Sundari Nanda, beautiful Nanda. So this is the Buddha's half-sister, and he also had a half-brother named Nanda. The Nanda and Nanda. Nanda, the ah in the end is feminine. So they both wound up ordaining under the Buddha. And when Sundari went with the other women, the Sakyan women, to get ordained, she really didn't wanna so much. She was really beautiful, and she was into her body. She really, you'll see. But she went along, you know, in part because her family, a lot of the men had gone to ordain already, and then when the Buddha came back and his father had died, and then his stepmother, Mahapajapati, wanted to ordain, and a number of other Sakyan women. Sundari went with them because what else is she going to do? And what we're told is that she was into her beauty, and the Buddha, through psychic powers, produced a vision. And I have no doubt that this can happen. I know this happens, it still happens with Arahant monks sometimes. Something can appear in your mind to help you understand, thanks to them. And what was appearing to her was a vision of herself aging right before her eyes. And she saw the true nature of the body. And so it says here, this is the Buddha's words, Nanda, see this body as diseased, impure, and rotten. Cultivate awareness of the unattractive with a well-collected, one-pointed mind. As this is, so is that. As that is, so is this. So now that's hard to understand, but it means both this body and a dead body are the same. What's in the dead body is also in the living body. So that you know, reflection on what's going to happen to this body. Only fools enjoy the vile smell of rotten winds. And I looked at it in this way relentlessly by day and by night, and I saw it for myself with wisdom and had a breakthrough. I heedfully investigated the origin of things and accurately see this body inside and out. Then I was disenchanted by the body, and I became dispassionate, heedful, unbound. I am quenched and at peace. She became an arahant. I know. It is amazing.
Just like that.
Just like that.
I really saw the relentless, like she really applied herself to that.
Yeah. She went on, she full bore. She really... really took it on. And of course, she's in the company of her brother, the Buddha, and all of this family, many of them also becoming arahants, but many of the men had already become arahants. So she had a lot of support.
It was a family business. Yeah.
It was. kind of karma is that? Now, Subha. I really love this one, I gotta say. Subha Bhikkhuni. Subha is beautiful. On one occasion, the nun Subha was going to the delightful Jivaka mango grove. You know, she's going to go meditate in the forest. And then suddenly a rogue appeared and stood blocking her way. And Subha said this to him, "What wrong have I done to you that you should stand there blocking my way? It's not fitting, sir, that a man should touch a nun." So he's grabbed her arm and he's detaining her. And she continues, she says, "I deeply respect the Buddha's path. The Sublime One has taught us about the precepts. I protect those precepts purely. I am taintless. So why are you standing here blocking me?" She's already saying she's an arahant. She's an arahant already at this time. "Your mind is dirty and my mind is pure. You're a defiled person. I am a taintless person with no lust. I'm liberated from every single defilement. So why are you standing here blocking me?" And he says, "You're still young. You're not ugly. What good will nunhood do for you? Throw away your robe. Come, let's enjoy ourselves in this forest full of blooms. The blooming shrubs release a sweet smell in all directions with pollen of their flowers. This is the beginning of spring, and the weather is very comfortable. Come, let us enjoy ourselves in this forest full of blooms. The trees with blossoming crests sway in the wind as if they were singing and dancing. You've entered this forest alone. What enjoyment is here for you? This fearful forest is inhabited by packs of predators and surrounded by cow elephants agitated by rutting bulls." I don't know, would you fall for this? I'm sorry. "In this frightening great forest, do you wish to walk alone without a companion? Your beauty is beyond compare. You're like a statue of gold decorated with the finest Kasi cloth. Oh, incomparable one, you shine with beauty like a decorated golden statue. You're like an angel in the Chittalata forest." That's a heavenly forest. "I'm dazzled by your beauty. If we both were to live together in this forest, I would devote my life to you. Oh, you have crystal clear shining eyes like that of an angel. There's no other person dearer to me than you." Oh my God. Okay. "If you will grant my bidding, come and live happily with me in my house. I will offer you my luxurious palace and servant girls who will always attend to your needs. Then you will wear kasi, the finest of all clothes, and put on flower garlands and perfumes. I will make you many ornaments of gold, jewels, and pearls. In that palace there is a bed made of sandalwood with a comfortable mattress and a well-washed, beautiful coverlet. It's spread with a new, cozy woolen quilt. You can sleep very peacefully in this fragrant bed. So why are you living this life of a nun? It's like a blue lotus lake possessed by a demon. Because of your celibate life, you will grow old with your limbs untouched by any man." Subha says, "What is that you consider substantial here in this body, which is full of filth, filling the cemetery, and is destined to break up? What is it that you appreciate so much when you look at this body?" "It's your eyes that I appreciate. Your eyes are extremely beautiful, like those of a doe, like those of a nymph who lives between the mountains. When I see your eyes, my desire for sensual pleasures increases all the more. You're like a golden statue. The eyes in your face can be compared with the petals of a red lotus. By seeing your eyes, my desire for sensual pleasures increases all the more. You, the one with big eyes, you, the one with pure gaze, no eyes are dearer to me than yours. You nymph with pleasant eyes, even if you go far away, I shall always remember your eyes." "No, you wish to go by the wrong path. You seek to have the moon as a toy. You wish to jump over Mount Meru. Understand me. The one you wish for is a daughter of the Buddha. In this world, with its gods, nothing can arouse lust in me. I don't know what lust is anymore. My following the path of Nibbana, I have rooted out lust. Like sparks from a pit of burning coals cooling down, like destroying a bowl of poison, I destroyed lust. By following the path of Nibbana, I have rooted out lust. You may seduce a woman who is not insightful, or one who hasn't seen the Buddha through the Dhamma, but not me. You bother me. As I have realized the true nature of life. Whether I am insulted or praised, or feel pleasure or pain, my mindfulness is well established. I have understood that all conditioned things are disgusting. My mind does not cling to anything at all. Just as you see a picture painted on a wall of a woman colored with paints, if people mistake it for a real woman, it's because their perception is distorted. You are blind. You run after an empty thing, which is like an illusion placed before you by a magician. You run after a golden tree someone had in a dream. You're like playing in a puppet show in the midst of the people. These eyes are like little balls set in hollow sockets with a bubble in the middle smeared with tears. Inside these sockets are the eye secretions, various sorts of tendons and flesh rolled into balls. The pretty lady Suba was not attached to her eyes. With an unattached mind, Suba suddenly tore out one of her eyes and she said, "Here, take this eye for yourself." And straight away she gave it to the man. Instantly, the rogue's lust ceased. And he begged her pardon. "Oh, celibate nun, may you recover soon. Such a thing will not happen again. If one tries to attack a noble nun like this, it's like embracing a blazing fire. It's like grabbing a poisonous snake with your bare hands. That person won't gain any happiness. Please forgive me." The nun was freed from the rogue. I went to the excellent Buddha. The very instant she saw the one with great marks of excellent merit, the Buddha, her eye was restored to its former condition.
You're right,
you're here. Yeah. I'll bet his lust ceased. Just like that. Yeah. Take a pause. Any comments? It's a pretty straightforward story.
I was just thinking, you know, there's just enough of a cultural difference that the things that he thinks are so wonderful and fabulous don't really ring true for us in our modern age, so it's easier for us to understand what the subtext is here.
Yeah.
But he elaborates so much that you just get an idea that really he isn't going to stop.
That's right.
So
She was able to stop him, but it was pretty extreme.
Yeah, she had to shock him to really get him to stop. She had to really do something totally shocking.
Yeah.
That
was the nicest thing she could do for him.
Sorry?
That was the nicest thing she could do for him.
Well, actually, it was the kindest thing of all, because he was immediately contrite.
Yep. That's right.
He immediately understood what he'd done.
Yep. So. Came to his senses.
Yes. I puzzle over the use of, and this is a language thing too, so I'm not really sure.
Get the microphone.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I puzzle over this too, and this is a language thing, so I'm never quite sure how to look at it. You know, in some translations you get disgusting, and others you get what disillusionment or whatever, and there seems to be a kind of a gradation of terms for you to be disenchanted.
We're going to talk about these terms tomorrow.
Good.
And it's true, the translation can go different ways.
Okay.
Just for the sake of the recording, I want your comment to get on here that you didn't have the microphone for, about how suddenly, because of what she did, he became contrite.
Yes.
Immediately became contrite.
He immediately was contrite, yes.
And this is like, what a gift she actually gave him. Yeah. Thank you.
Good. I'm glad we'll talk about those words.
Yeah, we'll talk about those words. They come in a sequence that leads to Nibbana in a number of suttas, and we're going to look at that sequence tomorrow. Yeah. Yes, Joe.
This, then, is the path to Nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
Then one of the things is a complete repression of the energy of life. Because we know, everybody here better than me, about the development of become a teenager, mm-hmm. young adulthood, how much the energy of sexuality is stronger than when you are late in life. Then these shoes, the I see, is like a extermination of the human race. If everybody goes, that is the goal also in this process,
well,
that we go. I have some friend in Thailand, and they tell me that they go to the temple once or twice a year mm-hmm. to give some offering for the monks.
Yeah.
And they have a life that does not appear to be close. I'm not making judgment about these people. By the way, they describe me, they have a life like a Brazil, Ipanema, in Brazil.
they love to party.
They love to party. They have all these issues. They consider themselves Buddhist.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, being a lay Buddhist, you're not going into this. Uh-huh. This is what you do if you want to leave the samsaric cycle. Okay. You know, it's like, that's what keeps us in this samsara, all that desire, all that energy. Okay. I don't know if it's true, but I was told that somewhere the Buddha says if there were two such organs, he wouldn't have been able to make it through. You know, like, that sexual drive, if there was another such kind of strong, he wouldn't have been able to. I don't know if that's really authentic, but the idea is that, you know, I know it's kind of a bitter pill to swallow, because this is why a lot of people don't teach it, that this really is the way to Nibbana. And when we go through enough suffering, we're ready to hear it. Because do we really want to do it again and again and again? Do we really want to perpetuate this? You know, it's like, this is something to contemplate. But nobody's forcing. The Buddha didn't say that the lay people have to be celibate and none of that. You know, just be virtuous. Just keep the precepts. Don't harm people. You know, have a good situation in your next life because you were good in this life. You know, and then, you know, as people develop, they start to see, like she said, the negative side of everything in this world. And you still see the beauty. And we're going to talk more tomorrow too about, you know, like what the joy that comes with spiritual practice and the joy that comes with awakening and the complete freedom from all of those forces, passions, and how peaceful and beautiful it is. So, yeah, it's something to consider. Should we go on to the next one? Parasarya Bhikkhu. The monk Parasarya was a meditator. When he was seated alone, secluded, these thoughts came into his mind. As a human, one should work for one's own benefit. He should act without harming others. What should be his duties? What should be his behavior? A human's sense bases can be used for his welfare or his harm. If he doesn't guard his senses, they will surely lead to harm. If he guards his senses, they will certainly lead to happiness. Therefore, the one who acts for his own good and the one who doesn't harm others should protect his faculties well and handle them properly. And he's talking about the sense faculties. When his eyes chase after beautiful forms, if he doesn't understand the danger of that unrestraint, he won't be able to escape from suffering. When his ears chase after beautiful sounds, if he doesn't understand the danger of that unrestraint, he won't be able to escape from suffering. Not knowing about the removal of desire, if he smells things being caught up with sweet fragrances, he won't be able to escape from suffering. If he recollects flavors, thinking this is bitter, this is sweet, and this is sour, his mind will be tied up by craving for taste. He won't be able to understand the nature of this mind. If he recollects tangibles, thinking this is lovely and is pleasant to touch, his mind will become attached to it. As a result, when lust invades his mind, he will have to suffer with various pains. When mind objects enter his mind, if he's unable to guard his mind from those objects, he will have to suffer because of all of the five senses. This body is like a beautiful and attractive painted pot made by a skillful artist, but it's filled with pus, blood, and a lot of filth. Life is like something bitter with sweet enjoyment, a painful thing which has a pleasant attachment. The one who doesn't understand this lives like one who licks a razor smeared with honey. If a man is passionately attached to the form of a woman, the sound of a woman, the touch of a woman, and the scent of a woman, he will have to suffer with various pains. These aspects of a woman flow into a man's thought like a rapid stream. But if he can stop that rapid stream, he's a great hero. He is the one who achieves goodness and lives by the Dhamma. He is a wise and skillful person. Even if he's a lay person, he will reach goodness righteously. Even as a lay person, he doesn't engage in unbeneficial things, understanding the things clearly that shouldn't be done. He acts wisely and diligently. One should practice whatever is connected with goodness and whatever pleasure is produced by wholesome qualities. The combination of these truly is the supreme happiness. Some people desire to take others' belongings by cheating them. Such people even have killed, beaten, and inflicted suffering on them trying to forcefully grab their belongings. The wise person knocks out desire for senses using those same senses. It's like a strong person who knocks out one peg with another peg. Such a wise person develops the five spiritual faculties: faith, effort, mindfulness, stillness of mind, and wisdom. With these five developed faculties, he strikes the five senses. Indeed, he is a Brahmin who is freed from suffering. The noble person has achieved the true goal of life and has become established in the Dhamma. Having acted according to the words of the Supreme Buddha, he has realized everything. He has prospered in supreme happiness. So there we see the reference to lay life as well as monastic life. And, you know, it's true that there are a lot of people in Thailand who are Buddhist and go to, you know, the temple, the monastery twice a year. It's like Catholics that go on Easter and Christmas. You know, it's the same thing. Do you really live according to the religion or not? It depends, right? Maybe yes, maybe no. And what he's saying here is do what's good regardless, you know, do what's wholesome. There's much more joy and beauty and happiness in that. And again, we talked about wholesome relationships. And we can have wholesome, committed relationships. Okay, hands are going up left and right. I think Allie's first, and then Adam, and then Dahlia. Oh, were you two? Oh. Okay, you at the end. Okay, Allie. There she is.
So this might be a stretch.
Okay. Can we do it concisely?
Very short.
Okay.
From the perspective of the interpersonal and personal that we've been working on developing practices based upon the precepts and what has come before, the stretch that I am seeing and sensing, and I don't have a desire about it, but I have a wondering, and that is that should we replace some of these words with the ecological concept, that if we were to treat ourselves and others as we might begin to learn to treat the earth, that there would be also a change at the collective level. I'm just putting it out there.
Yeah, for contemplation.
For contemplation, for further revelation.
Thank you. Adam?
I was just going to ask you to talk a little bit more about this knocking out one peg with another peg, using the same sense. I think I have an idea, but...
Yeah, the Buddha uses this simile in a sutta in the middle length discourses called The Removal of Distracting Thoughts. And it goes back, I believe, to when they didn't have nails, or they weren't using nails, but they were using wooden pegs to join lumber. And then you could, the peg in the that's joining it might rot. And then you take a strong, good peg and you put it on that one, and then you hammer it in and the other one comes out. So I think that's what, you know, like you're knocking out the sense desire with a different sense desire, with a different sense, with your still with your faculties. And then he starts to talk about the five faculties after that. You know, what are you doing to remove that lust when you're just tapping it out of there?
But it's a different sense.
It's the same idea. It's, well, in a way, it's the same. You mean a different sense from the where he uses it with removing distracting thoughts?
No, it's a different sense organ that he's using to do it.
Oh, a different of the five senses.
Yeah.
A wise person knocks out desire for senses using those same senses. It's like a strong person who knocks out one peg with another peg. So one example might be if the sight of someone is what's bringing up the lust, then the sight of the skeleton might bring up, you know, knock that out.
Right, that's exactly what I was thinking it might be referring to.
It's a good example.
Yeah. Or the beautiful voice would have been blocked out by some terrible sounding shriek or sound or whatever.
Maybe, I don't know, maybe. I think Dahlia's next, maybe.
Okay, I know this is opening up a big topic, but I suppose we'll be dealing with it a little bit tomorrow when we look at the language that's used here, because I do question sort of using aversive imagery in order to control natural bodily processes. You know, I think that can be dangerous. And, you know, maybe I'm particularly self-controlled, but I don't need to think of something as disgusting in order to back away from it, you know? So, and I work enough with people who have felt disgust for their own selves that encouraging that feels...
You definitely don't want to encourage that.
No.
Yeah.
No. And, you know, dispassion feels like a very appropriate word to, you know, being able to, like, get the flame down, you know.
Exactly.
Through compassionate action, you know, like get out of the room. You know, if you're feeling inappropriate sexual arousal to somebody you shouldn't be near.
Right.
So, I you know, the language is, in these practices, I've always struggled a little bit with, you know, I don't need to think of how gross the inside of the body is. That doesn't feel like it would do anything except for to scare me, you know, and that's not wholesome.
Yeah, so. I think it's very important to notice, I mean, this is what I find with the suttas in general, trying to understand the context within which things are being said and recognize that things are said in different ways throughout the suttas. So you have to read more broadly to, you know, to gather that. And I think for us, you know, it is the case that a lot of times the monks, and they would talk about, you know, like really knocking out that strong sense of lust, but really it is the purpose of getting that to die down, right? And so for myself, it doesn't happen very often, but a while back, I just saw something on the internet that brought a huge fire up inside of me, lust-wise. And that image was still bothering my mind for the next, like, day or something. And then I imagined it without the skin, and it totally calmed it down. But I didn't feel like suppressing anything. It's just bringing that alternate image that is also true and just allowing the body to, and the feelings to adjust to that.
So it's not intended to build aversion, because that's...
No.
Where, yeah.
It's not intended, because aversion is also a defilement.
Right.
So you're not building that at all. That's right.
I think it's tricky.
It's very tricky.
Yeah.
That's why we have to be on top of it. We have to really understand what we're doing. We have to be very mindful and careful with it. It's not aversion. No. It's big. And I really could say I didn't have aversion when this was going on in me. And for the subject of it, I could have compassion. You know, so it's like, yeah, this is sensitive territory that we need to navigate quite skillfully. And definitely the body image harm that's caused in our culture has to be addressed, and we have to take care with how we recommend how people, you know, work with whatever it is they want to work with. That's why we need our psychologists. Yes. Give me your card. I'm not kidding, actually. You know, we send people to therapy, you know, like, just like we would send someone with addiction issues to that support. Okay, we've got a lot of hands back here. Sarah first, I think. Oh. Go ahead. I don't know.
It's just a really quick observation that sort of just something clicked for me, which was that in not cultivating aversion, it seems super important, because that's where... It seems like aversion would be the place where you would start to develop dehumanization.
Yes, and that is not
the
Dhamma.
That is something that I have always, like, I feel very allergic to, and that I see in some other traditions.
Yeah.
And has always, like, this is a subject within Buddhism that I've been very, like, what's going on here, you know? Yeah, because we don't want to do that, I don't think.
No, definitely not. That is not Dhamma, for sure. The rising of compassion for the subject in that image was really the desired, like, result. I mean, not you can't make it happen, but you definitely, if it goes towards the side of aversion, that's entering a different landscape of defilement.
Yeah.
you want to work with that. You don't want to let that take root either.
And is compassion to come?
Compassion.
Instead of
aversion. Yes. In the example that I'm offering, that was actually what was happening to me, what arose was compassion. The lust calmed and the compassion arose.
For yourself?
No, for the subject. Yeah, the thing I saw. For Sonia.
That's really beautiful, and I wish I would have had that level of nuance 15 years ago when I started doing meditation retreats. I just, like, this worked for me. You know, and I wasn't thinking about whether I was being compassionate. I just needed something to get me through what my mind and body was doing for 10 hours a day of meditation for 7 days in a row. Like, I needed something. And I had come across these, some of these suttas, and they worked. Yeah. So, you know, I think we have to remember, too, you know, people's age and biology. And, you know, sometimes I think about the young men in monasteries and, like,
That's it. You know, a lot of times the Buddha is talking about, oh, women are sharks. Well, like, you know, I can see him saying that in front of a bunch of young guys, you know. And if it were me talking to young women, I might say that about guys, you know. It's just not in a way to degrade or to dehumanize, but to just try to help them.
But I think
sort it out.
You know, now I'm a little older, and I can relate to some of what you're saying about, like, now if it's more just kind of the base biology kicking up once a month or whatever it is, like, then it's less about something outside and more about just sort of understanding my own body and just witnessing that.
Yes.
So that distinction feels helpful.
And when the Buddha also talks about how we are enamored of our own sexuality and our own bodies when we become lustful for someone else, and then to really turn around and look at that too is very helpful.
Helpful, thank you.
Lisa wanted to say something first, I think. Back this way. Yes. Thank you.
No, I was just wondering about compassion for one's self in this process.
I didn't need it. You know, but of course, like, I'm not, I mean, I think wherever we're having any kind of negative sense for ourselves, and of course, maybe compassion is important. Mm-hmm. You know, like, it has come up a few times that there's a lot of teaching about self-compassion because our culture really needs that. Mm-hmm. But in this case, that wasn't an issue.
So I'm getting stuck a little bit on this idea of repression.
Yeah, because that's not where this goes.
Right,
yeah.
And maybe that's my Catholic upbringing, you know, but that repression that I felt like I had to push against.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Because that, too, was toxic and harmful.
Yes. And it backfires. You know, it's just, it doesn't work. No matter what the emotional state is, if we suppress it, it backfires. It doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And it's not mindful. It's not being present. It's not being sensitive. It's not, you know, it's one of the ways you fall off the ridge. Mm. You know, you're sliding down one side, you're going into the ditch over here if you indulge and you build up the feeling that you go down the other side. So you need to stay on that balance, on that middle way. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think it is important to be sensitive to where self-compassion is needed and make sure that that's where we take some time and offer whatever is needed for ourselves in that regard.
And of course, this is an area where aging is a gift.
Yeah, probably. And having, developing the kind of moral integrity that we're talking about and the kind of generosity that we're talking about really helps to have a good feeling about ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't have to have so much compassion for ourselves because we're not suffering so much. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so back to Janine.
This kind of ties into where the conversation just landed. And I guess maybe this is a thought that maybe I don't, like, I know the poetry and the verses, and there's very specific language, and that's like one category. And then I think I'm also just reflecting on other parts of the practice that we've discussed, and especially around self-compassion. So they might be separate, and this might just be a personal thing, I'm not sure. I'm intrigued that, I guess for me, it's like when you talk about these cravings, these lusts, these passions, like I automatically think of like fiery element, like in a very natural world sense. And I feel like for everything, like earlier we were speaking about the two ends of the meditation, of the ethics, the kama, and I was like thinking of an hourglass, like I'm surprised that like transformation of, call it a sense, I see it as energy, isn't more acknowledged. And I guess in the sense of the practice, like, and again, I know that this is specific writing from a certain time with specific language, so now this is just like a personal reflection, I feel that, I don't know, I'm just interested that something more transformative isn't mentioned, or even as we're talking about it. Like, I think that's what we're getting to, but
I actually think it's there, but maybe not in the language we're using these days. Because the transformation is from, you know, being an ordinary, as Bhikkhu Bodhi's word, ordinary worldling, to this, the transformation of being the noble person, and awakening. So that is a transformation of the energy.
Yes, and I think like in some of the other comments made, like it, not seeing it as aversive or repressed,
right.
And even in the example you shared, like, I guess for me, it's within my own practices, like, I feel if something of a lot of fiery energy comes up, there's that sense of acknowledgement that's there.
Yeah.
And
mindfulness.
Yeah, mindfulness.
Present with that experience.
Yeah, and not, you know, going for it or like falling into it.
That's one side where you go down a hill.
Yeah. But then also, I guess, not averting it or making
it. That's
the
other side down the hill.
Just something disgusting. But seeing it as something, and something I was writing that you've been saying is this presence, this emptiness, like this, like, allow your mindfulness to be bright. And like in the sense of generosity and in the sense of service, like, and I guess for me, maybe it's probably just going to take a moment, and it's probably the same as like hearing the words that are averting or repressive, like how someone would, even if it was the most, I guess for me, and maybe it's my own capacity, unique capacity, that, I don't know, I guess at this point in my life, something that causes such great like passion that you can almost get lost in, for me it then becomes a transformative tool of like, well then how can the energy within me become brighter so that I can transform also how I serve, how I show up, how I can see compassion for myself and others, whether it's related to the same subject matter, mm-hmm. have it be something that whatever a passion-lessful situation could be. And I guess in the sense of helping others transform that, but to like acknowledge it and transform it into something, I guess you can call it maybe something like a self-empowerment, self-love, but also knowing that that goes beyond just the I, the you, and it goes.
Done in the right way, I think it's the same as what we're seeing here.
Mm-hmm. And maybe it
that we don't get lost in being enamored with the passion.
Correct.
And we actually use those faculties, those qualities of faith and wisdom and the actual like effort, the mindfulness, the samadhi to actually cause that transformation. So this idea of being good, the previous, and you know, practice whatever is connected with goodness, whatever pleasure is produced by wholesome qualities. So it's the goodness, the wholesome qualities, those skillful faculties, that's what's needed to make that transformation. And we have to be careful not to get too caught up in the passion. That's where mindfulness is so important. It's an object to you, just like your suffering is an object to you. You know, begin to understand the passion also as suffering. And it can be transformed in this way, as long as we don't get carried away with it and we don't repress it.
Thanks.
Yeah, thank you. Okay. Sujata, this is from the Sangyutta Nikaya, so that's the linked discourses. At Savatthi, the Venerable Sujata approached the Blessed One. The Blessed One saw him coming in the distance and addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, this clansman is beautiful in both respects. He's handsome, good-looking, pleasing to behold, possessing supreme beauty of complexion. And he is one who, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge in this very life, enters and dwells in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from household life into homelessness." And this is the verse. This bhikkhu shines with sublime beauty, having a mind utterly straight. Detached is he, free from fetters, attained to nibbana by non-clinging. He carries about his final body, having conquered Mara and his mount. The beauty is there, and the beauty is that incredible brightness of the enlightened mind. That's the end. The end. Well, this is, in my opinion, this has been an incredibly fertile discussion, and I appreciate everyone's contribution to this. And I must say, I hope we can make that public. Is anyone uncomfortable with that? You're good? All right. I think that could be incredibly beneficial to people. Thank you. So now we'll wander over to the Dhamma Hall to close the evening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org. www.lnscape.org/donate.